Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Support for this podcast is provided by Subchuck Law. Revolution Recap thanks Subchuck Law for their support of our show, local independent media, and their mission of bringing unbiased truth. Revolution Recap would also like to thank Six Point Builders for their support. Six Point Builders are builders of fine custom homes in the Boston metropolitan area.
Welcome to another episode of Revolution Recap, part of the Believe Network. We're coming to you after the New England Revolution concluded their season with a 2-1 victory over the Philadelphia Union, thanks to two Gustavo Bo goals. That win left the Revolution in the fifth seed heading into the playoffs with a first-round matchup coming against number 4 seed Philadelphia again, kicking off next Saturday. I'm Sean Donahue, joined today by Greg Johnstone. Greg, how's it going?
Doing well. It was a very great weekend, a beautiful fall weekend down here. Got to get out a little bit, got to go to the zoo, got to see the Revs win, got to see the Patriots win, which I did not see coming whatsoever. And I've been crushing it on my World Series bets, not so much on the soccer bets, but I've been crushing it in the World Series bets this week. ALCS, NLCS bets, I should say. So all things going well down here. Sean, how are you?
I'm good. You know, I spent most of this week in London. I'm a little bit jet lagged still. It still feels a little bit later than it actually is for me. So hopefully I'll make it through this one. I think it's going to be a very long one. But I got to go to Wembley for England versus Italy earlier this week. And then I also got to tour Tottenham Stadium. So all in all, a good week. Patriots win.
Yeah, we probably don't have time for a Tottenham 20, but it's the first time we've done a show together. Do you want to do maybe like the Tottenham 10 and give us a real quick update on how the Spurs are doing?
I mean, Spurs play Monday, so they were in first place, but now they didn't get to play yet this weekend, so they're no longer in first place. But so far, it's been a fantastic season, and for the first time in a while, they're actually fun to watch. So, again, can't complain.
Definitely won't end in disappointment.
Anyways, I should have segged right into our sponsor talk because you're talking about your good bets on MLB. And where's the best place to do that? Bet Online. It's a Texas showdown in the MLB postseason. And Bet Online is your number one source for all of your baseball wagering info with up to the minute stats, news, scores, and matchup breakdowns. Get the latest game odds, spreads, and totals for the NFL and college football at your fingertips with Bet Online's real time updates on statistics, news, and odds. They have everything you need to stay up to speed on each LCS all the way through the World Series. Head to the website today or use your mobile device to get in on the action. Don't forget to use promo code BELIEVE, that's BLEAV, to receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. Bet Online, where the game starts. Greg, a lot to talk about today. Are you ready to get into our takeaways, which are brought to you by our friends at the Rebellion Supporters Group?
Yes, I would love to get into our key takeaways. And my key takeaway here, too, is this is exactly what the team needed. This was a close game, 2-1. And Philadelphia, you know, if it wasn't for an offsides call towards the end, looks like the Revs would have conceded again late, which is a little concerning that there was a free runner on that set piece there. But overall, I think you need to argue that the Revs were the stronger team of the day. 2.08 expected goals to 0.83, according to FootMob. The Union's goal was, I'll say, kind of fluky, totally an error on the Revolution's part between...
And also offside.
also offside, but you could also argue, I feel, Jacob Jackson could have gotten red carded for his kind of half tackle there, don't you think?
Oh, it was a penalty kick 100% if that was actually correctly called offside.
Yes. So either way, I think that a Union goal is fair in that scenario, and I think there's a lot of blame to go there on the Revolution. But I think skill-wise, the Revolution came out and were the stronger team, and that's the first time we've seen that really since League's Cup, in my opinion, that we've had a game that the Revs really looked confident and strong. If you look at the heat maps and if you look at the passing networks on MLS Soccer, I mean, the wingbacks were able to push up forward and they played pretty phenomenally, if not phenomenally, pretty well. They seemed very dangerous. It seemed like this was a team that knew where to be. They were very functional. The offense was clicking. Just a very confident performance and very different from bleeding goals in the past couple of weeks, kind of adding in new wrinkles to the scheme and not really working out. It seems like they kind of went back to basics. And, you know, I think I've talked about this before. I don't blame PA for trying new different things, because as I say, I don't think the Revs would have won MLS Cup with the way things were going when he acquired the team. But he did read the room and saw that we need to go back to what the way this team was playing before. And I think this, I don't want to say this is a get right game, but they needed one of these before going into the playoffs. And I think going into the playoffs against this team that you just beat is only going to add some more confidence. So I'm a little bit more glass half full than I've been the last two or three episodes that I've been on this show. But this is exactly what the team needed. And as I say, not a commanding result by any means with a 2-1 victory. But I think on paper and in the locker room, this is going to be a big boost for the Revolution.
Yeah, I completely agree. And it was one of those games, too, where they started well and then they gave up that fluky 13th minute goal. And you thought this could be the moment where this team collapses, right? Because even with the good start, with everything that's gone on, you were wondering if this moment would just destroy the team and the good start they'd have would fall apart. And it didn't. You know, they continued to play well. There was a little bit of a moment there, I think, for a little bit where they weren't as into the game as they were early, but they found a way to get back into the game, scored those two goals. And the resilience, given everything that's gone on, and then given that fluky, pretty bad goal that they gave up early on, to go away and get a win here, I think is huge for this team's confidence going forward. Had they lost this game, I think all of us were writing the team off and ready to see them lose in the first round in two straight games and have that end quite quickly. But this game at least gives you some hope going forward that this team can actually pull things off. And my takeaway is very similar to yours, so I guess I won't separate it. My takeaway is that there's enough talent on this team to make some noise in the playoffs if Clint Pie keeps the tactics straight forwards and relies on those who are performing. And you mentioned the tactics. It had been a bit of a mess over the last several games. He tried a few different things. Last week you can kind of throw away because he didn't have many options given who was available. But the inverted fullback with Matt Polster playing left back and midfield at the same time, clearly it wasn't working, and I think it took him a little bit longer to get away from that than it should have. But this game, he finally went with two natural fullbacks, having Spalding on the left, Dewan Jones on the right, it's his center back pairing of who was available with Dave Romney and Andrew Farrell, and the team looked a lot more comfortable playing in positions where these guys are used to. Matt Polster was back in the midfield, and then putting Tommy McNamara, a guy who was a key part of this team in 2021 when they won the Supporters Shield but missed a lot of the season injured and hadn't started yet this year, I think that was kind of a calming presence to have his veteran leadership out there, and probably something that the Revs needed given how the last several weeks have gone. So, I have a lot of questions about Clint Pie's tactics over the past several weeks. I think he got it absolutely right in this game. And, the Revs showed that, again, beating a team in Philadelphia that they're going to be playing right now in the first round, that there's certainly enough talent on this team for them to make some noise in the playoffs if they keep doing what they did in this game.
And if you look at the attacking three in Bo, Heal, Chancalay, I think what really... it seems like it's clicked with them. They seem to all play off each other very, very well. All of them had 5 shots on the day. Bo had 1.17 expected goals. Heal had 0.55. Chancalay had 0.35. They're also passing back and forth. Bo with 0.11 expected assists. Heal with 0.52. Chancalay with 0.34. They all seem to be connecting very, very well with the wingbacks around them and with each other. So I thought this was a very good showing by the Revolution, and they seemed very dangerous from start to finish on the attacking side of the ball. So one more thing, though, and we'll talk about the play between Jackson and Romney a little bit later, but I want to talk about probably the most disturbing and just horrific part of that play is what was Apple TV doing with that double screen? If you're going to bring up a goal from a different game, can you put it in a little mini screen in the corner? Like, I appreciate the kind of going around. I appreciate the decision day coverage. I think that's one of the benefits to Apple TV, and I think they nailed it. But can you please not take up 2/3 of the screen? I'm trying to watch the game. So just a little memo there to Apple TV. I know the executives listen to every show, but my goodness, what on earth were they doing there? Anyway, just had to get that out.
Yeah, I know you. I agree with everything you just said there, but you know, the striker situation too, I think, is something we should talk about quickly, and what Clempier did, which I think that's what he also got right here is, you know, we've been talking about the Revs needing to play with two strikers up top, and making an opportunity for Fiorini to play better if there's a striker next to him, or if Gustavo Bo needs a striker next to him. But instead of trying to force Wood or Fiorini onto the field, who neither of whom have been performing lately, he put his three most talented attackers, three guys that can create opportunities for themselves and for others and don't necessarily need a lot of help to get a shot off, in Gustavo Bo, Chancle, and Carles Hill, obviously. And, it worked very, really well. And you talk about Gustavo Bo and wanting to pair him with kind of a natural striker with, some heading ability and Bobby Wood. But I think he made the right decision here is, yes, Gustavo Bo might not be at his best as the lone striker, but the team is probably at its best playing in that situation and in that formation. And, he found a way to get his best talented attacking trio on the field and playing, even if it didn't necessarily, result in a two-striker system that everyone's been saying they need to play, at least not with a natural striker next to Gustavo Bo.
Well, I think a lot of the two-striker discussion was around Giacomo Vrioni, who did not play in this game. And truth be told, I think at this point, he hasn't figured it out. We've talked all season long about him figuring it out, and it seemed like he was kind of turning the corner at League's Cup, but it seems like he's kind of fallen off a little bit. So I think this is your lineup and your tactics going in. This is the best they've looked in a while. So, hopefully they look as dangerous as they did last night.
Yeah, I agree, with the exception of, maybe Henry Kessler goes in for Andrew Farrell if he's healthy. But other than that, I think this is the lineup, and Clempier's finally found it. So yeah. About time.
Well, I also Kessler too. The team said he's being held out for precautionary reasons as he recovers from a hamstring injury. I don't know if that makes sense. Like, I'm not saying that's not true, but it doesn't make any sense to why he hasn't played a full 90. He's played about 100 minutes over two games. You don't know when your next game is. I mean, we know now, but it could be another, week and a half off or a week off. So it was weird that at the very least he wasn't on the bench. And I think Seth McComber reported that he didn't train on Friday, but the team made a point to say he was at training all week, or I don't remember the exact wording. There might be some technicalities working around with the wording, but I don't know if I'm 100% confident on. I imagine if he's healthy, he's going to be in there. But a little concerning that he is missing this game and is at the very least not available on the bench.
I think it's very concerning. And I think, regardless of what they said, it implies to me that there was, some sort of setback, even if minor, right? Like, it's hard to see him, if everything was going smoothly and in a good trajectory, that he would have, sat out of practice and then not even been in the squad for this game, because it was a home game too, right? Maybe if you were traveling somewhere and you didn't want him to go on a plane, and maybe I could see more of it, but not even including him on the bench to me implies there's some sort of setback. I don't have inside knowledge to question what they said, but it doesn't quite add up to me.
The ink hasn't even dried on that contract yet. Maybe he hurt his wrist signing that big new deal of his.
Yeah, it's not a great sign. Anyways, we have a lot of questions. Should we jump right into them?
Absolutely.
All right. Let's start with also Alfred on Twitter, who says he did not like Gustavo Bo taking the penalty kick with Carles on the field. He thinks in his head that Bo is about 80% success rate at the penalty kick and Carles is 98%. I personally found it unusual that Bo was taking that. What was your thoughts on that? It surprised me.
I'm surprised too. I think Carles Hill is your best penalty kick taker. Let's read between some lines here. Sometimes you give the penalty kickoff for sentimental reasons. And I know there were some comments after the game about Gustavo Bo. I believe he was talking to Sam Minton of the Blazing Musket. Maybe it was Tom Quinlan of WPRO, where Bo is aware of his contract situation. He's enjoying, if these are his last few games in New England, he's enjoying them. I wonder if Carles Hill gave that to Gustavo Bo, and they had some sort of agreement because Gustavo Bo may not be scoring many goals in New England anymore. No, of course, he scores later in the game. But my guess is that it has something to do with Gustavo Bo potentially being on his way out.
So my guess was, I did not think that deep into it. That makes some sense. My guess was that it was simply the Revs don't have strikers that have been scoring goals, and Gustavo Bo scored his last goal on August 3rd. They need some momentum going into the playoffs. They need a goal scorer to get hot. And my thought was that, you know, here's an opportunity for Gustavo Bo to put one in the back of the net before the playoffs and you know, maybe get his confidence up and get going just in time for the playoffs. That's what I was thinking. I still didn't love the idea. If he doesn't score, I think there's a lot more questions about it. But my thought was that maybe they were trying to just get him some confidence and have a striker put a ball in the back of the net before the playoffs start.
It is worth noting, too, I believe in these stupid playoff system, 90 minutes and then it goes straight to penalty kicks, which is how it was in League's Cup. So odds are, you know, if you make a deep run in the playoffs, at some point you might have to do maybe it's just that way for the best of three. I'd have to double check that. But either way, there's a very good chance Gustavo Bo is going to need to step up and take a penalty kick with the game on the line or have a very big impact in those penalty kick shootouts. So maybe it's just to kind of shake off the cobwebs and kind of, as you say, get the confidence up.
Tail Forever on Twitter says, "We seem to defend better in transition today. What changed?"
Very, very good question. I think, one, you're going back to the normal four-man back line and I'll call it a 4-2-3-1. I mean, the shape obviously fluctuated around a little bit, but you kind of went back to your old system that you are used to. You're not doing a three-man back line with Kessler and Omar and Romney needing to go out and kind of cover the space on the left wing and Kessler kind of swinging out to the right wing. There's no inverted left back situation where Polster's up the field, and so your center backs kind of get spread out a little bit more. I think this is just a formation that they are comfortable with, and I also think, too, Tommy McNamara coming back in, we talked about this a little bit, you know, Tommy McNamara and Polster have played together a ton. And so even though this is his first start of the season, and even though he's coming off of an Achilles injury, which, you know, he's getting up there in age, I believe he's past 30, he's going to know his roles and responsibilities. And so I think this was just a formation that everyone on the team kind of knew their responsibilities. They knew where to be, and it was just a little bit easier for them to gel. So I'm guessing this is just kind of a familiarity and knowing their roles. Whereas the past month, you can kind of tell, even though they've practiced things and worked on them in training, out there when you got to the game, it was pretty easy for teams to figure out, you know, just boot it down the wing and chase after the ball, or, you know, get one center back to step up and it's a total scramble. So I think they were just a lot more organized yesterday.
Yeah, I agree with it. And I think just having Polster back in midfield makes a huge difference. He's been such a key part of this team in that defensive midfield role, and letting him play his natural spot and not have to also play left back, it makes a huge difference. And then you mentioned Tommy Mack as well and the comfort level there. So I think that combination has had a lot to do with it. Tail Forever also wants to know, were there logical subs the Revs could have made? And Porter on Discord says, rate the lack of substitutions. Would you have done anything different?
Yeah, the subs were interesting. And I've looked at this a few times. I feel like you should bring on some subs at some point. I think Mark Anthony Kay coming on at some point, whether it be for McNamara or Polster, would have been fine, kind of as a defensive substitution. I think you could have put on Omar Gonzalez if you were really trying to park the bus and take off either Sean Calais or Noah Buck. You know, Ima Boateng didn't come in, but you didn't need a goal, so I understand why he didn't come on. I understand why Wood and Vrioni did not come on, although I wouldn't have hated Vrioni or Wood, for either one of them, for Gustavo Bo earlier than Justin Renix, maybe, you know, at the 75-minute mark. But I think sometimes when coaches feel like they're in control of the game and they're on the stronger foot, why make changes? And so I'm guessing that's what Klimpier did yesterday. So I don't blame him too much, but I would have put in Mark Anthony Kay probably for Tommy McNamara, maybe in the 75th minute, just to get a little bit more defensive and kind of add, I don't know, get some fresher legs out there. Because as I say, this still was a 2-1 game, so I think you could have gone a little more defensive at some point.
Well, I guess that depends on if you think the Revs could have gone and scored two goals and jumped into the fourth seed, right, and then had home field advantage for the playoffs. And I think that was part of the reason why you wouldn't necessarily make a sub defensively, because you're kind of balancing between two minds here, and that, you know, you want the win for confidence, but also there is a tiny chance you could jump into the four seed if you score two more goals. So you don't necessarily want to go defensive. And maybe in the 90th minute when you bring on Renix, you bring on Kay to lock it down, because at that point you're not going to score two goals. But I can kind of see why it was tough for Clint Pieda to make a sub in this one. And it also gets down to, like you said, they're trying to hold out and get the win. Things were going right. Do you really want to switch things up? And unfortunately, a lot of the guys on the bench haven't necessarily shown too well under Clint Pierre. I've made some catastrophic mistakes under Clint Pierre where you wouldn't necessarily want to bring him on. So I look at the bench, and I do have trouble kind of figuring out who you want to bring on. Kay is the obvious one, putting him on for McNamara. I think that's one that I would have thought about doing, but he hasn't been that great in recent weeks. And then, I'm always a fan of bringing on Boateng when you have an opportunity, but I don't know that I would have in this game. I certainly wouldn't have taken out Chonkele. Maybe you take out No Buck and you give Boateng a run out. I wouldn't have hated that idea, but all things considered, I'm usually questioning Bruce Arena when he was the coach and not making subs, but in this one particular situation, I kind of get it.
It's also worth pointing out too, because you mentioned moving up in the table, and I would need to go back and look at an exact timeline of where teams were in the live standings, but Atlanta finishes with 51 points. The Revs finish with 55 points. So even if they conceded two goals to Philadelphia late, they still would have finished in the five seed. So it's totally possible that someone has pulled up live standings and is telling Clint in the 70th minute, there's really no downside to losing points here. We need to go for them. We need to get up that goal differential and overtake Philadelphia in the final few minutes. I could totally see that being in the equation. So we need to put in two more and we'll get a home game, as opposed to, if we, draw this game, it really doesn't mean anything standings wise. So I think that's, now that you've said that, I think there's definitely a good possibility that was going on.
Yeah, it's really a tough spot to be in, because again, for momentum reasons, you want that win, but winning by two more goals would have made a whole world of difference for the Revs. Certainly having two out of three games at home is huge. We'll see how that affects the Revs going forward. But I completely get why you'd want to have in the back of your head that get two more goals, get the four seed. A couple questions about Tommy McNamara. We talked about him. Derek Terrell on Twitter says, 2021 Polster plus T-Mac duo is back. They were great. Keep Kay on the bench. TSB11 on Discord says, who had Tommy McNamara being a better fit for our midfield than Mark Anthony Kay in their 2023 bingo card?
Yeah, I don't want to hammer it too much, because I know we have a million things to talk about after listener questions too. But Tommy McNamara has some familiarity with Matt Polster and this system. 82% pass accuracy on the day, 40 for 49, 54 touches. He had five passes into the final third. He had five recoveries. He was 1 for 3 on duels. As I say, not too much action on the defensive side of things dual-wise, but, certainly seemed to kind of fit like a glove, and it was nice to see him get a full 90 minutes after suffering that terrible Achilles injury earlier this year. But, he's not a sexy player. He's a journeyman MLS, midfielder who's been around forever and bounced around, and he's over 30, and, I know a lot of people get on him for being kind of the weak spot, but he's a very good role player that can kind of come in and fill a spot start. And it sounds like Ian Harkes is not coming back anytime soon. So, hopefully we can recreate some of that 2021 magic with T-Mac.
Yeah. Only thing I'll say is that, I did not necessarily see Tommy McNamara as coming in and being a starter playoff time, but I'm not shocked that Mark Anthony Kay hasn't worked out quite as well as some had hoped, because as I've said before, he hasn't been that player he was in LAFC in several years. So, you'd hope that you'd make it a little bit more out of him than you have. And he's been, serviceable, but I'm not surprised that he hasn't been, world beater, must start type player from what we've seen so far. Mm-hmm. Several questions or comments and questions about Gustavo Bo, unsurprisingly. Derek Terrell on Twitter says, I said it last week and I'll keep saying it again, extend Gustavo Bo, even though that was really bad goalkeeping from Blank on the second goal. Teal Forever says, I know it might be Bo's last regular season game. If it is, what a wonderful way to end, especially the classic Bo to Carlos Heel goal. And DC on Twitter says, Bo has to be re-signed. The best pure scorer we have. Can we get him on a Max Tam deal?
Yeah, it's worth noting, too, I believe Frank DiLapa of the Boston Globe tweeted out today that Gustavo Bo now has 50 goals for the Revolution across all competitions, which is quite an achievement. And he's going to go down as one of the greatest, Revolution strikers of all time. With that said, and the rules might change. Maybe they're going to add another designated player spot, so it's not as egregious if he's a designated player. But a lot of the conversation I hear about Gustavo Bo is, well, bring him back on TAM money, bring him back on, you know, lesser money. You know, maybe Gustavo Bo doesn't want to take a 50% pay cut. Maybe he doesn't want to take a 60% pay cut. And that's essentially what you're asking him to do. So I don't know where his demands are, but I think at his age and the amount of games he plays, it will be very hard for the Revolution to bring him back as a designated player, in my opinion. I think it's, if he's willing to negotiate his contract down to $1 million, $1.2 million, that might be reasonable. I think you could make an argument that's still overpaying a little bit for a kind of a luxury good. But, you know, it's he certainly is a quality player when he's on the field.
Yeah, I completely agree with all that. And I don't think it's out of the question that he would re-sign on a max TM deal. I think that that is possible. I mean, I think he was asked after the game by Tom Quinlan about, you know, whether this was his last game. And you know, he was talked about how much he liked it here and how this was the longest he's been with any club and his family has adapted well, his daughter's adapted well. Maybe there is a scenario where he wants to keep his kids in school here. He doesn't want to uproot his family. He's, you know, he likes it here and he's changed his mind a bit about going back to Argentina to play as the end of his career there. And he re-signs for max TAM, which is still a lot of money. And at this point in his career, maybe he's not, you know, he realizes he's not worth much more than that. So I could see that happening. If I was a betting man, I would say he's probably gone. But I'm not completely, you know, I'm not writing off that possibility. And with that said, I completely agree with you. I don't think you can bring him back as a designated player, given his age and given his general availability recently. I don't see his availability and his health getting better at this age. So, you know, he's been a fantastic player for the Revolution, you know, great goal scorer. He's it really etched his name into the Revolution history books. And if they can bring him back on a TAM deal, I wouldn't be opposed to that. But I can't see him coming back as a designated player at his age, given his availability. So we'll see what happens. But his comments I found interesting in talking about how much he liked it here and how much his family likes it here, because I think that, you know, any player that comes into their mind when they're thinking about their next move is, you know, is their family happy where they are, and will they be happier where they go next?
So. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it's worth noting, too, last couple of years, he had 1,600 minutes played in 2022, 1,266 this year in 2023. So, you know, he's about – that's a long way off from 2,326 in 2021. So his minutes are declining down, and you essentially have to play him as a guy that – might be available 60% of the time. And that's really hard to justify a designated player spot for. Even if you add one, it's just really, really hard to justify that unless you have a very, very strong team and you essentially don't need that other designated player spot. I'm just kind of reading through the quote here, Gustavo Bo, and then we'll get to the next question. But Bo said, quote, "Yeah, I know it could be one of my last games here. We all know my contract ends at the end of the season. I haven't talked too much or had many conversations about my future, but I just try to enjoy in the moment and focus on day to day. That's my mentality, and that's the way I've been since my first day here. If these are my last games with the club, I want them to be my best games, and I want to play them in the best way possible. These 4 years, I've enjoyed them a lot. My family has adapted well. My daughters have adapted well. Bruce was really confident in bringing me here, and when he brought me here, and I'll always be thankful for the club. There's a phrase that I always say, football takes you where football wants to take you, not where you want it to take you. It's my first time in my career that I spent this many years at a club, and I'm just filling the contract, and I'm enjoying this, thinking that it could be one of my last games, make me emotional because I've had so many great memories with this club, but that's all I can say." That sounds like a guy that's on his way out. And so I don't know if it's he's demanding too much or if it's that the Revs are looking elsewhere, or it probably is a little bit of column A and a little column B. But it sounds like he's on his way out.
Yeah, I'm just trying to, unfortunately, look up the max TAM number for next year just because I'm curious. But my guess is also is that it wouldn't be as big of a pay cut to go from his DP salary now to a max TAM deal next year as you might think. But I still think the most likely scenario is he's gone.
Shout out to Josh and I for sending that to me as soon as humanly possible, by the way. I quick DM. Hey, someone send me that Gustavo Bo quote, and Josh and I is there to pick me up. So shout out, Josh.
Thank you, Josh. Anyways, so now we've got some questions on Tomas Vasilík. Not surprising. James Downing says, "What is going on with Tomas Vasilík, and is Jacob Jackson good enough to lead the Revs to an MLS Cup?" Sam Mitten, our good friend from the Bet Musket, says, "Hello, Greg. First time, long time. Do you think that Tomas Vasilík graces the field in 2023? And if so, is that the best thing for the team? I'll hang up and listen. Eric Hopskit Bullock on Discord says, going into the playoffs, do you like what you've seen from Jackson, or do you go back to Earl?
Well, let's put that last one aside. Let's just talk about Vesic. I don't think we see him at all. And I know there was a quote, too. Tom Quinlan reported that the Revs signed Vesic despite knowing his persistent mobility issues. Once we're set of Vesic, he can't walk straight. I 100% believe Tom in his reporting. I find that quote very interesting. I wonder if that's someone from Revs management or maybe a player that has seen Thomas, because I imagine that management, you know, I talked about this with Andy a few weeks ago. They obviously had him in for a physical. And, you know, if I'm trying to explain what exactly is happening here, my guess, if I'm to guesstimate, is that, you know, they were blocked from Josh Cohen. I don't know if we explained this on the pod, but there was a story a few weeks ago that Josh Cohen filed a grievance against Atlanta United because Atlanta has his homegrown, or not his homegrown rights, sorry, his MLS discovery rights, I believe. And Josh Cohen, who's playing in, I believe, the Israeli Premier League, wants to return to MLS, and the Revs were interested, but Atlanta essentially had, you know, unreasonable expectations for a trade, and they offered him an MLS Next Pro contract, and so he's essentially blocked from returning to Major League Soccer. The Revs also tried trading for the backup from Portland. That seemed to get shut down. So they clearly had some other targets, and I'm guessing what's happened here is Vetsleek came in for a training session and a physical. They flew him over from Europe. It was probably a situation where he's not going to fly back and forth to Europe. So they saw him, you know, train once, and they said, you know, let's roll the dice and maybe he'll get in shape. And he just hasn't. It's very bizarre that this signing was made, because the reason you make this signing is now. And if he's not going to contribute right away, why do you sign him? So I don't even remember the questions. Do we see him this year? I would say no. We're going full force with what we've had, and I think they only use him in case of an emergency. Even if he is healthy, it doesn't seem like he's performing very well. And then what was the first question, Sean? I don't remember James Downing's question.
Oh, is Jacob Jackson good enough to lead the Revs to MLS Cup?
Oh, and that touch – well, no. But to touch on to Eric's question, though, if I've seen – enough of Jacob Jackson, if I'd roll with him or if I'd go back to Earl. You know, Jacob, obviously, with the communication error with Romney in the first half, but that's not an indicator of skill. That's kind of a communication issue and a communication breakdown, and that comes with time. Skill-wise, I think Jacob Jackson has shown a pretty solid reaction time. He's made some pretty solid saves. He's had a couple blips on the radar, but, you know, he's been testing these two games, and I'm not nervous about him. I don't have much difference in my mind between Edwards and Jackson right now, but I think in case of a tie, you go with the young guy, and I think he's played fine. I think he's done very, very well, minus the communication error with Romney, and hopefully that gets ironed out over the next few weeks. But in terms of skill and athletic ability, I've been fine with Jacob Jackson. So I think that's who you're going to see going forward, and that's who I'd go forward with.
Yeah, I agree. First of all, I don't think there's any chance we see Tomas Vasilik in 2023 unless there's serious injury problems that lead to them needing him in an emergency. But otherwise, I think there's no way at this point, if he didn't play in the regular season, that he plays in the playoffs, barring injuries. But yeah, I think you stick with Jackson. I think we've seen him play two games in a row. I think Clint Pia is going to stick with him. I think the ceiling is higher with Jackson. I think he's a better shot stopper. You know, I think with Earl, though, you probably have a higher floor, in that, you know, Jackson's not that experienced. You saw that mistake in this game. I think there's potential you see more mistakes. But I think if you're going on what gives you the better chance of going far in the MLS playoffs, I think you go with Jackson. And I think that's what they're going to do. But again, you know, he's only played two games. Don't be shocked if there's more miscommunication errors that could lead to another goal. I think that's the risk you're taking by going with Jackson. So,
And I believe Brian Bolello made a comment at the Supporters Summit, which we'll talk about later, but he made a comment that's like, you know, Kevin Hitchcock is picking the guys that he thinks is best suited. It seems like Hitchcock has a lot to say in who's getting the starts, and I trust Kevin Hitchcock a lot. So I'm fine with Jacob Jackson, but you're right. It seems like a riskier pick with a lower floor and a higher ceiling.
Yeah, that was a very interesting quote, I thought, from Brian Bolello at the Supporters Summit. But yeah, I also trust Kevin Hitchcock's judgment on who's the best guy to go with. Just one more question on this. Well, partly on this. Georgie Petrovic fan page on Twitter says, I would like to know opinions on signing Vasilik with his injury history, and do we keep Giacomo on for another season after two straight seasons of no real improvement, or do we cut both of these guys and look for a new DP striker and a day-in, day-out goalkeeper?
Well, in terms of Vasilik, I kind of touched on this. I don't know if you want to expand any more, but this is a signing for this year. So, and he's not going to play this year. So right off the bat, it seems like a failed signing. Now, we said this at the time. This guy has the resume. He did a good job with Huddersfield Town. It's just a matter of being fit and being healthy. So maybe he comes in next year and plays very well. But, you know, if Jacob Jackson plays in the playoffs and looks fine, do we need this guy? I have major questions on why. Why did we do this? And because it just seems like they made a move out of desperation. And I mean, certainly Earl Edwards and Jacob Jackson, you know, they're not Georgi Petrovic. Those are tough shoes to fill. But I also don't think those guys are horrible enough that it's like, well, we got to sign someone. So this was a major, major judgment issue here. And I'll also say, add, and I've talked about this a couple weeks ago with the Henry Kessler thing, Kurt Arnolfo's contract is up at the end of the year. He probably wants to have a deep playoff run, and that's probably going to help him, you know, keep his job and keep his sporting director job. I'm sure he's in the running because he's done a good job with the academy. So a deep playoff run certainly helps your chances. And, you know, maybe he's making this signing as kind of a roll of the dice, because if it doesn't work out, well, he's gone anyway. If it does work out, he's a genius. So I maybe there's a little bit of that behind the scenes too. Do you have anything to add on that, Sean, or should I hop right into the next question on that?
Well, I just want to say, based on his resume and what he's done in his career, I completely understand the signing. It made sense to me at the time that you go out, you find a, you know, veteran goalkeeper that's been a starter in La Liga. He had just stepped into another situation, another difficult situation, where a team that was, you know, in the championship in England and needed to kind of be rescued by a backup by a goalkeeper when their goalkeeper got injured. He stepped in the middle of the season, took over, did a really good job, earned rave reviews from the fans there. It seemed like the right fit for what the Revolution needed in a situation where, you know, it was late in the transfer window. You had to get a free agent. There was not much opportunity for the Revolution to, you know, go out and really explore too many options. So on paper, this looked like a good move. On the other hand, I don't understand what went wrong with the medical, where they didn't realize he was, you know, this out of shape and this not ready to play. That to me is the real failure. But I just want to say, in some sense, if you look at his resume and, you know, where he was coming from and all of that, that, you know, this move made a lot of sense on paper. I just can't believe that they got to the situation where they didn't necessarily, or maybe they did know what they were getting and took the risk, but that's where I'm very confused as to what happened.
And Bilello also said at the Sports Summit, we brought in a free agent that we thought was fit, which is also a telling quote, right? So frustrating, very frustrating. You'd think a guy that just went in and had to come in a pinch at Huddersfield Town, you know he has to come in a pinch and play right off the bat with the Revs. So somewhere down the line, either the Revs didn't do due diligence or this guy just wasn't in shape and, you know, took the summer off and had one too many Coronas. So in terms of Rioni, I think, you know, you're going into your playoffs. He's not in the starting lineup. We've talked about this all year long, Sean. We previewed the season. We said a lot of this season is going to come down to if Rioni can figure it out. He figured it out for a little bit, but I mean, he's not starting. He hasn't scored a goal on the road in his entire Revolution career. It's been a year and a half. He came in older than Adam Buksa when Adam Buksa came to the Revs. I don't know if you cut him, but I certainly think you look into selling him, even if it's a loss, you know, sell him back to wherever he played before, Austria or Albania or Moldova or Belarus or whatever. Find a club that, you know, in a league he can score in and recoup a little bit of that money and move on. I think that's what you got to do at this point, because I personally don't have confidence in him. I don't know what he does elite. If you're talking about a designated player attacker, you know, you need someone that is elite at something or can do something really well. You know, Shankalai can, you know, move through the defense really well, and he can score and he can assist, and he takes a lot of pressure off of Carlos Gil, and he opens up paths for Carlos Gil. Carlos Gil is still one of the best playmakers in the league. Gustavo Bow, he's not what he was, but at one time, you know, anytime he was shooting the ball, it had a chance of going in, even if it was 10 yards outside the box. What is, you know, Buksa can score anything in the air on a header. What is my elite thing from Brioni? He's not particularly fast. His runs aren't amazing. He can really strike a ball very well from, you know, and finish his chances inside the box, but he's kind of a post-to-post striker, and he's not really getting open, and he's not great in the air. And I think he scored one goal from outside the box, and it was that game against Montreal where I think the goalkeeper could have done a little bit better. And his production is pretty comparable to Bobby Wood's when Bobby Wood is in the game. So there's nothing that Brioni does incredibly well. and there's nothing elite about his skill set in Major League Soccer. And I think you do your best to move on from him. I'm not 100% sure if I would use the offseason buyout, especially if a fourth designated player is coming in and Gustavo Bo leaves. You could work around it with Rioni and maybe give him a little bit more time and maybe start that first half of the season and maybe use the midseason buyout like you did with Josie Altidore if you really need that space next summer. But I think the Rioni experiment, the Revs should be looking into their options on that one.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it comes down to who's the next coach and who's the next sporting director, right? Because maybe there's another coach that comes in that wants to play a different system that looks at Rioni and thinks, you know, maybe he fits what I want to do more than, you know, what's been done in the past. But if it's me, I'm looking at opportunities to move on from him. I agree with you that it would be kind of a tough sell to use the buyout on him. He's got 2 years left on his contract plus a club option. The Revs paid a $4 million transfer fee for him, and then they're going to eat another $4 million on salary to let him go. I think that's going to be a hard pill to swallow. So I, if I'm the Revs, I'm exploring options to move on from him and find a team that, you know, is still interested in him that they could transfer to, even if it's a loss on the transfer fee. I'm sure Vioni is not happy either, and I'm sure he's probably a willing kind of transferee to go somewhere. But I think you do everything possible to move him somewhere, and then, you know, maybe see what the next coach wants to do otherwise. But I think, like you said, the summer buyout window seems maybe more realistic to give him another 6 months or another whatever, however many months to try to figure it out before you sink all that money again in a buyout of him. But, you know, if there's an opportunity to move on from him, even at a loss, I think you take it.
It's a good point about the new coach, though. Maybe the new coach implements a system where no aerial crosses, two strikers, and all of your games are at home against weaker opponents. I think that would fit Vioni very well.
Like Vasilik, you look at his resume and you see he was, you know, second leading scorer in the Austrian Bundesliga, and you think he's, you know, he's got to have some talent, but we just haven't seen it. And at some point, you don't think you're ever going
to
see it.
Oh, and his resume compared to Buksa, I mean, my God, Buksa was coming in from, you know, the Polish division, and he was very untested. He was very green. And Vioni, you know, Juventus Academy, a golden boot winner in Austria, which is no, you know, better league than Poland. Certainly more polished, it seemed like. Just didn't work out. Sometimes the resume Juventus does not translate. Yeah, it's crazy.
So, I mean, I don't know. That's a tough one.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Also, Alfred on Twitter says, Spalding is serviceable. I don't ever want to see Pulser at outside back again. Kim Dawson on Threads said, Spalding seemed to find a lot of success out on the left, and he's been a bit of a head scratcher as to why they didn't use him sooner. He should stay in the starting 11 for the first playoff round. Wasn't a perfect game, but felt like we got a glimpse of what the Revs had earlier this season. Thoughts on Spalding?
Yes. Nailed it. Very good performance, I thought. He's a very suitable left back. Better than Ben Sweat, in my opinion. I think Matt Polster also doesn't want to see Matt Polster at outside back. This game seemed to suit him very well, playing kind of in an attacking role. I still think defensively he's not amazing. I still think that, you know, there's a drop off from Brandon Byatt right back to Ryan Spalding at left back, but he's a very, very good backup left back. And I'm curious to see what the Revs do with him in the offseason, because you have Peyton Miller right behind him. I'm curious to see if they try to keep him in some capacity, because when we've seen him, it hasn't been perfect, but he's done a very good job for the role he's playing on this team.
Yeah, I agree with all that. I think he's, you know, at times not had some good games this year. I'd like to have seen more from him, but I thought he played really well in this game. I definitely think he's better than Ben Sweat. And given all your other options, I think you absolutely need to start him in the playoffs and start DeJuan Jones on the right, because I also do not want to see Matt Polster at left back ever again. I wouldn't say I never want to see him at right back again, except for the fact that I think he's the Revs' best number six, so you need to keep him in midfield. I agree with all that. Spalding should be your left back going forward in the playoffs. Og on Twitter just says, my thoughts, I want to believe, and had a picture of a spaceship. I don't know if we need to respond to that one, but I think everyone wants to believe at this point. Steve McGrogan on Twitter says, Bo Believers Unite, T-Mac comeback is awesome. Put players where they want to play and watch the magic happen. I also think that's a good thought. I don't know if you have any comment there, but yeah, I think that builds on what we said. Put players where they want to play and things work out better.
Everyone knows that now, especially Clint Pie.
Traeger on Twitter said, did Clint Pie finally find his best 11 and then banish the rest of the team to the shadow realm? I'm assuming that comment has something to do with the lack of subs.
Yes, and Kessler for Farrell, which we've talked about, and also, as you kind of talked about, maybe the situation here with the standings, the subs were played a little bit differently. I think that if this is a game where you 100% need to win, and you know, maybe you're playing a little bit more defensively at the end, like I said, so I expect to see Ima Boateng as an impact sub coming off the bench at some point. I expect to see Mark Anthony Kay in the defensive midfield for Polster or McNamara at some point. And Omar, I think too, is going to be coming in at some point. You're going to have him be your kind of closer, your third center back, if you're parking the bus, if you need to, you know, stay up a goal. But all things considered, I think that this is the starting 11 with Kessler stepping in for Farrell. Yes.
Alden on Discord talks about the only other potential switch that I could see. And he says, we put Polster and T-Mac in the pivot and had Noel and Carlos switch in possession. I feel like I'd rather see Polster and Noel in the middle, Carlos doing what he wants, and add another high offensive output player on the wing spot, because Noel is great there, but it's not like he's a big danger from there. Any thoughts on that one potential change? And personally, that is the only other change I would consider making, although I think Tommy Mack did fine and was good next to Polster in this game.
Yeah, you know, Buck, if you look at his heat map too, he was playing kind of as an attacking right midfielder. But I thought that was fine. And if you look at where Carlos Hilo's playing, he's also kind of in that zone most of the time, kind of playing on the right. He's kind of more freewheeling, but he's there with Buck as well. And I think they played well off of each other. So I get his point, but, you know, who else? So you move Buck to the midfield. Who are you putting in right attack? So Nacho, which, you know, maybe. I think he's had a string of games and it's been fine, but you could do Esmir, although Esmir has not played a ton of games lately, I don't believe. So I think it's more of a selection issue. And I think Tommy McNamara, as I say, I think that worked out very well. So maybe they make that change if Tommy McNamara kind of falls out of form a little bit. But I think that Noel Buck kind of playing that attacking right spot and kind of, you know, connecting with Carlos Hill a little bit, I think that worked out perfectly fine.
Yeah, Esmer wasn't even on the bench for this one, which is interesting. Now that you say that, I didn't make anything of it at the time, but
was he on international duty? I'm trying to remember exactly where he was.
Oh, I think you might be right. Yeah, I think he was the one that. I think you're right. Good call. I think he was the one that is international duty extended into the weekend. So yeah, good point.
But either way, I mean, unless you're trying to force Wood or Vrioni on and move, you know, maybe do a 4-2-2, you know, and two strikers, which I would not want to do. But I think a 4-2-3-1. I'm not sure who put in that right attacking spot, and it kind of fits naturally like glove, unless you're talking about Nacho Heel, but I hit or miss. I'm hot and cold with Nacho Heel. I some days I think he's perfectly fine, and some days he's a very frustrating player.
Yeah, the only reason I think this is something I would consider is because I thought Noel Buck paired very, very well with Polster earlier this season, and the two of them had a lot of chemistry and played really well together. But I don't love the options of who you'd put out wide or in the more attacking spot in that situation. So that's why I'm not convinced that I would do this. But I do think that Buck is very capable of playing as an eight and next to Matt Polster, and the two of them worked really well earlier in the season. So I could see them doing that, and I could see a situation where the Revs maybe want to, are trailing or want to go for a goal, and maybe you pull Tommy McNamara out, you put Noel Buck next to Matt Poulsen, and you bring Ima Boateng on to run at guys and put Chonkley on the right and Boateng on the left, and maybe you do that. But all that said, I think the lineup we saw this game was the lineup that we see next weekend.
Absolutely.
All on Discord also ask, what could the Revs have done differently this season to go into playoff series feeling a little more feeling like they had their stuff together better? And then he says, Bruce not saying some heinous undisclosed stuff, Barrero and Bai not tearing knee ligaments. I think we could spend 2 hours in the offseason analyzing what could have done differently this season for the Revs for things to go better. I don't know if there's anything to add here. I think the items he puts out there are part of the list, but this is probably too long of a question to answer tonight.
Yeah, this is already going to be a very long podcast because you have a million things to talk about after the listener questions. But I guess you could say the team should have been prepared to lose Petrovic a little bit more, and maybe sign a player to take over for next season. Maybe a younger keeper that kind of fits that mold of, Turner or, Petrovic. And maybe you have that plan B ready to take over because you knew you were selling Petro in the winter. Maybe you can kind of say that as captain hindsight. Obviously, the outside back lack of depth. Obviously, Bruce Arena saying something inappropriate. The usual suspects. I think it's a real big combination of kind of everything altogether, which is kind of. And I'll also say too, I think one thing that looking back on this 2023 season, this does not necessarily have to do with their lack of form, but one thing I'm really disappointed in is Jack Pantiatu and Esmer really have not gotten a lot of run out there with the team. Noel Buck has certainly come through, but I'm disappointed we did not see more appearances from them considering the number of games the Revs have played all year. And Jack P, I think he had a lower ceiling, but Esmer is really talked about as a high prospect on a national team level. And it's kind of interesting to see him get lost in the shuffle and get relegated to Revs 2 for almost the entire season when really you were kind of hoping to see him take that next step.
Yeah, all really good points. Trigger on Twitter says his nephew wants to know, do you think the Dewan no call in the box when he was shoved to the ground in the second half should have been a penalty?
No, and the ref let them play. There were some other calls that I was surprised were not fouls. Carlos Thiel and Gustavo Bo at some point took a real beating. So the Dewan Jones thing was not going to get called, especially in the box. That maybe a more strict referee would have called that, but the way this game was called, that was not going to get called for a penalty, in my opinion.
Yeah, I also agree with everything you said there. John Anthony on Discord says, what do you think is the best defensive formation in which players playing in the back are going into the playoffs now that we've about seen it all from Clint?
Just the formation, I'd say this one. Am I understanding that question?
Yeah. That's part of it. And then what players?
I think these ones. Line. Minus Farrell. These ones.
Yeah. I 100% agree. Again, with the Farrell Kessler question.
I think we've touched on that one, so I think we'll skip over that one. But yes, with these ones with Kessler and Farrell.
Yeah, I'm all about the four-man back line where you have four players actually playing the positions that they play in and aren't also supposed to be playing midfield as well as back line. Paulo S on Twitter says, it's hard to pick a man of the match, kind of torn between Bo and T-Mac. Always thought we'd figure out things before the playoffs, but we did leave it pretty late. Better late than never, and we can still get better. Are you excited about this team again?
On a scale of 1 to 10 on the excitement meter, I'm probably about a 6. I still am very skeptical. I was very skeptical this team was going to win MLS Cup before. I still think you're going to have to win one of the two games in Philadelphia. After this, you probably have to go to FC Cincinnati, which I don't think you're getting past them. It's a very tough road for the Revolution. The one speck of hope is that the Philadelphia Union, with the drama with Bedoya and Kai Wagner, it seems like there is, I don't want to say turmoil, but it seems like they're in a similar situation with the Revolution where just a lot of frustration, I think, with how things are ending there. And it seems like this is kind of an end of an era feeling around Philadelphia right now. So I think the Revolution are kind of eye for eye, seeing another team that is kind of going through some stuff in the locker room. And so I think if you are facing another team that is kind of hitting on all cylinders and has a lot of momentum going into the year, I'd be a little bit more skeptical. But you're playing a team that I think you match up pretty decently with on paper. And on top of that, they also kind of match you in the locker room turmoil. So I think this opponent is they're going to be good matches. And I'm not necessarily saying they're going to win, because I think stealing a game in Philadelphia on the road against a team that probably considers you a rival, they've had some battles over the past couple of years. That's going to be tough. So, Yeah, am I excited? I'm excited because it's playoffs, but I do not think they're going to make a deep run.
Yeah, I'm more excited about the opportunities the Revs have than I was a week ago, because a week ago I thought the Revs were certainly going to lose two games in a row and be out. I think now they actually do have a chance at giving Philadelphia a series, but I'm also with you. I can't see them getting past Cincinnati in the next round, so I don't think they're going to make a very deep run, but I think they could make a slightly deeper run than I thought a week ago, so there's some more excitement than there was a week ago, certainly, but I still don't see them in any way as contenders. Eddie on Twitter says, the point we lost from a goal called off against Red Bulls, the league admitted it was a wrong call, cost the Revs home field advantage, also got Red Bull New York into the playoffs. New York City FC incorrectly called off goals also cost the Revs third place. I hate referees.
Yeah, and you know, while we're doing the, you know, if this one thing changed differently, if the Revolution were able to tie Columbus at home in their only home loss of the season, Columbus would have two fewer points. And the Revolution would have one more point. So Columbus would be at 55 points, and the Revolution would be at 56 points. The Revs would have home field advantage and the third seed in the playoffs, and they would have clinched Champions League. So there's a lot of what ifs, you know, McCoon not booting that ball long, you know, holding Columbus to a tie in that game. You know, these final few games of Minnesota, go on the road at Minnesota and on the road at Colorado, and dropping points to teams you really shouldn't be dropping to, it's cost them a Champions League spot as well. And of course, the Andrew Farrell goal being called off incorrectly, which they at least publicly admitted. Yeah, there's a lot of what ifs in terms of the Revolution, and it's probably going to cancel them, probably going to cost them a Champions League spot, unless I believe a team that's already clinched a spot wins MLS Cup, in which case I believe the Revs are next in line for one. The Revs should be there, and it took a massive choke job for them to fall out of the Champions League, which exactly what happened.
Yes, and you can blame the referees certainly for lost points, but you can also, there's plenty of opportunities to blame the Revs and mistakes they've made and ways that they could have controlled their own destiny regardless of referees. And with all that said, too, I haven't looked into all the other teams that the Revs are competing with and points that they may have lost by bad refereeing decisions. So it's harder just for me, at least personally, to just blame the referees for where the Revs landed. There's a lot of blame most of the blame that belongs to the Revs themselves. Jake Katniss says, dumber playoff format, the MLS first round best of three, or MLB having six wildcard teams and getting their five best teams eliminated before the LCS?
So Jake's a Braves fan, in case you guys couldn't tell from that question. MLB's playoffs are dumb. I'm not going to say that, but I think there's no way for MLB to, you know, go from 162 games to shrinking it down. And so them expanding, you're always going to have this problem. I think they need to rework their playoff system in some way that benefits, you know, 100 win teams and teams that are on the bye, because the teams that are on the bye essentially are doing what Revs fans say from 2021, which is, we have too much time off, we're out of sync, you know, and these other teams are coming in hot. It's kind of nonsense. With that being said, MLS, these playoffs are so dumb. Not only is the best of three stupid, instead of doing just a home and away, I'd rather do home and away for more than one round than doing this stupid best of three series. But it is ridiculous that teams like Kansas City, who I think was winless, the longest team that was winless, I think, at the beginning of the year, or they were at the bottom of the standings, somehow can fight their way back. Red Bulls are not a good team. Charlotte's not a good team. Montreal had a goal differential of minus 16, and they almost made the playoffs. These are bad teams that are playing this late in the season. So, you know, I get it. More games, more money. But a lot of these teams suck, and they should not be in the playoffs. And I think where it really gets me is the best of three format. And
for one round only.
Yeah. And if you want to get a home game for the, you know, every team, do a home and away. I mean, it's so obvious, in my opinion, for the way soccer is kind of set up around the world. So it's kind of more just like the MLS is not taking the obvious option, and they're just adding on games for the sake of money and revenue.
Yeah, I think do a home and away, which they've done in the past, and have less teams in the playoffs.
Yes.
So I think MLS is the dumber format for all the reasons you said. Evan Ryan on Twitter says, Revs versus Philly, best of three. Format still sucks. I think everyone agrees. Do we get the 2021 rivalry, or do we get a non-competitive series?
It'll be competitive for the reasons I talked about a few minutes ago. I don't want to spend too much time on it because we're already running long, but yeah, it'll be competitive.
Yeah, I think it will too. Again, I wouldn't have said that a week ago, but now I do. Charles Maddox on Twitter says, "How important is the first match in Philly on the day? It was a come from behind win and a total 90 minutes performance. Also, I want to give everyone on Revs Recap a big thank you for all you guys do for soccer in New England, and thank you for all your coverage throughout the season." Well, thank you, Charles. Really appreciate you listening and that comment. But Greg, how important is the first match in Philly?
Yeah, just big thank you to Charles and everyone who sticks with us. I know that, you know, we do an hour, and the episodes like today, it's going to be more than an hour. But a lot of people, you know, we retain listeners week after week, and we really appreciate the people that tune in every week or close to every week and send in questions. And it really means a lot. And I don't know about you, Sean, but for me, it's the reason why we're still doing this. So big thank you to all of you guys for another fantastic season. But in terms of what was the question, I don't even remember.
How important is the first match in Philly?
Pretty important. I mean, if you take that game, you have the chance to win at home, which I think really gives a massive advantage to the Revolution. I mean, either way, you're going to have to win a game in Philadelphia. It's huge. Every game is huge, though. I think really the second game is the most important, because that is the game you 100% have to win no matter what. If they lose the first game, I still kind of feel like it's kind of like a holding serve type thing where, okay, we can come home and we can win this home leg, and then anything can happen in a game three. I feel like number two is essentially the one that's way more important.
To me, I think the Revs have some momentum from this win in the last game of the regular season. And I think they need to go into Philly and have a good performance and, you know, hopefully get a win. If they don't and they lose and they play poorly, then I think the momentum's gone. And so in that sense, I think it is important, because I think they've had no momentum. They finally got a little bit of momentum. It's very important they carry that into game one. And, you know, if they lose a close game, it's not devastating. But if they lose that game in a, you know, disappointing fashion where they're not playing well, So I will say it's important in that they need to have a good performance in a competitive match. They don't necessarily need to win it. It would be huge if they did. But if they go into that game and lay an egg, then I think that it's going to be very tough for them to find any momentum again.
No, I'd agree with that.
DC on Twitter says, "Can we get a Revs recap shout out to Michael Bradley's retirement? Like him or not, the dude was a great captain who led by example, one of the best midfielders in U.S. men's national team history, and a genuine great person." I'll take this first. I've always been a big fan of Michael Bradley. I think as a number eight, he was a fantastic player for the U.S. men's national team. In his prime, he was, you know, one of the best players, if not the best player on the field for the U.S., I thought. And it's unfortunate that I think he takes so much criticism for, you know, what happened in 2018 and that situation and not making the World Cup. And too much of that is held against him, because when he was at his best and playing in Europe and in his prime, he was a fantastic player and one of the best midfielders the U.S. men's national team has ever seen.
Yeah, and it's also sad he's going out on – I mean, I shouldn't say it's sad because I'm enjoying Toronto's misery this season, but they're going out certainly at a low point in Toronto. And I believe his career, I don't know if he played with the United States men's national team much after Trinidad and Tobago, but that essentially was the end of his career with them too. So he kind of is going out on some low points, but, you know, he had a major impact on soccer in the United States and the United States men's national team. And we talk about the growth of soccer and, you know, obviously the 2002 team has a ton to do with that, but that 2010 team, I know they just got out of the group stage, but I feel like there was a lot of momentum of soccer coming out of that as well. So, we look at the growth of soccer in this country, and Michael Bradley was right there. And I'll also add that, you know, this is a guy that left Roma to come to Major League Soccer at a time when Major League Soccer was not a hot commodity by any measure of the imagination, you know, before Messi and Insigne and, you know, all the other super, you know, Zlatan. I believe he was before Zlatan, but, you know, Michael Bradley came over, I believe, pretty relatively young. I mean, he's been in MLS for 7 or 8 years now.
Yeah, I think he was only 27 or 28 when he came back.
He left a very promising career in Europe and in Serie A, where Serie A. I don't know why I said it like that, but he left a very promising career in Italy and with Roma to come to Toronto FC. And him and, you know, I know Josie did not work out very well in Europe, but, you know, I remember Sebastian Giovinco was with the Italian national team, and he kind of came over as a very surprising move. You know, he took a big chance on Major League Soccer too. So Michael Bradley deserves some credit, I'd say, for being there with the growth of soccer in the United States with the national team. But also he made a very big career choice coming to TFC when he did, when the league was not what it is today. And he was one of the guys that I think, I don't want to say put MLS on the map, but him and Giovinco and Josie and what TFC did, I think that was the beginning of people looking at MLS as a place that, you know, maybe players in the prime of their careers can go.
And you know, I gave him a lot of credit too, because people talk about him leaving Europe too early as a negative on him, but he also played 8 years in Europe. So it wasn't like he was just there a flash in the pan. He had a lot of success in the Dutch league. He had a lot of success in Germany. He had a lot of success in Italy. He even, you know, played a few games for Aston Villa in England. He had a very successful career in Europe, and I don't begrudge him taking a big payday and coming back to MLS and supporting the local league in that way. And you know, it was brave of him too to leave as a teenager to go over to you know, the Dutch Eredivisie and play really well there. So yeah, I think it's unfortunate, like you said, that his career is ending in kind of a low note in how Toronto played this year, and that his career at the national team, though it wasn't the end of it in 2018, was pretty close to the end of it and kind of the last major moments for him. So yeah, it's a fantastic player that I think sometimes is remembered for the wrong things, and you know, people that actually really paid attention to his career in his prime saw a fantastic midfielder that, you know, there's few like him that have played for the U.S. men's national team. So yeah, good shout out there from DC.
And it's worth pointing out too, and then we can move on. I this is turning into compliments about Sebastian Giovinco, but Sebastian Giovinco was left out of some Italian squads because he played in Major League Soccer. I mean, that's where the league was back then, that, you know, it was looked down upon very much. So again, I just want to kind of reemphasize that, you know, 7-8 years ago when he came over, it's not at all what it was now. It's a completely different league in terms of talent level and stuff like that. So, and as I say, that TFC team, I think really changed the course of the league for the better.
Yeah. Let's switch it up. We're done with questions. There's several other topics we want to talk about. First one, I want to get your take on the Athletic reporting that Bruce Arena has expressed interest in the DC United job. Should clarify that it sounds like they're not really looking at coaches yet there. I think they're in a similar situation as the Revs, where they're trying to hire a sporting director or a GM before they hire coaches. So that's also, I guess, an interesting, not to go too deep in, but also kind of interesting caveat, since Bruce, you know, did both those roles for the Revs. But any initial thoughts on that Athletic report?
Yeah, it worth the same grain of salt we gave a few weeks ago when, you know, Phil Neville was tied to the Revs job, and I forget who the other person was. But any coaching names now apparently are, you know, they're just names until a sporting director comes in. And then, you know, when names come out after that, I think you can take it a little bit more seriously. Also worth noting that Pablo Mar of The Athletic also reported that Bruce Arena threw his name in for consideration at DCU in 2018 before he came to the Revs. And that was as a GM, sporting director / head coach, similar to a role he played in New England. And DC United was not very interested then. So you would think if they weren't interested then, they might not be as interested now. Again, a sporting director would change that. But Bruce expressing interest, you know, I could express interest in the DC United job. That doesn't mean I'm getting it. This seems like, to me, like someone from Bruce's camp is sprinkling something to the Athletic that, hey, Bruce is out on the market and he's already inquired about DC United. I think that's kind of what's happening here. I would guess he's not landing in DC. I don't know who is going to pick him up after everything that's happened with the Revolution, but I will say that there was an article by Ian Nicholas Quillen from Forbes, and I highly recommend it. I retweeted it on Twitter, but if not, just Google it. But he makes a very good point that, you know, Bruce Arena has been out of a job for a month, month and a half. The investigation went on for a month and a half. If he takes a new job, he can't just go away quietly. There's going to have to be some sort of explanation to what exactly has happened here. And right now, the perk of Bruce Arena not getting a job and ending his career in Major League Soccer is he's going away. But the way it's been structured with Major League Soccer is he has to petition his way to be employed in Major League Soccer again. So if that happens, Major League Soccer has a lot of questions. They can't just hide on this one. Bruce Arena is going to be at press conferences every week, and he's going to get these questions every week, and he's probably not going to answer them, but it's going to be really, really bad luck. And by the way, DC United, if you're going to hire a guy that had to resign for inappropriate language, that probably isn't going to help you with the lawsuit that your former trainer is bringing against you because you fired him for doing the circle game, which, if you don't know the circle game, it has an alternative meaning, which is a big no-no these days. But it did genuinely used to be the circle game decades ago when I was a young lad. So, you know, if you're firing someone over a questionable gesture, it's hard to then bring in someone as a head coach with a much bigger spot of authority after he had to resign in disgrace for inappropriate language and conduct. So I would guess he has a 0.0001% chance of getting this DC United job. But this really, to me, is a signal, a little Bruce bat signal out to the rest of Major League Soccer that he's interested in coaching again.
Yeah, I think it's unlikely for all the reasons you said. I wouldn't go quite as low as a percentage as you did, because I think there are for DC United, they do need a change in direction. And Bruce Arena was the guy that when they, you know, the league first started, turned them into the league's first dynasty. So from that perspective, it would be a nice storyline if you ignore everything else that's happened over the past 2 months. And that, you know, here's Bruce Arena, who turned this team into a dynasty, coming back to try to fix them and make them good again. And for Bruce Arena, you know, a way to kind of cap his career as the team that he started his professional coaching at, to kind of end it there and make them successful again. So ignoring everything that's gone on, it would make a lot of sense and be a great story. But, you know, without there being an explanation as to what happened, for all the reasons you said, it makes no sense. So I don't see it happening, but I wouldn't put it as low of a percentage as you did. Salary data came out. We've already had it up for guys that were here already. But some interesting data points for the midsummer signings. Ian Harkes at just $252,000 guaranteed. That seems to be a bargain. I don't know if you have any comments on that, but that seems like a good move. Seeing that number, you certainly can't question why they brought him in.
Yeah, I mean, it was a 6-month contract that was guaranteed. I don't know what the 2-year option after this is going to be, so maybe there's a big raise there. But this was a great signing. I still am a little confused about the criticism about it. Very low risk, worked out really great. If he was still there, he'd be starting. So great signing. No complaints. I think Mark Anthony Kay we already knew about because we already had the TFC data. Then I believe Shankale and Vasilik were the only other signings that we now know. Is that correct?
Yes, and Chonkle is at $726,000 guaranteed. It's hard to know what that means for next year. I think that number changes, but that number with what he's playing like, that's another fantastic signing. And Vasilik is at $437,000, which is a decent chunk for a goalkeeper that's played 0 minutes.
It's worth noting these numbers are annualized, so it's over a season. But yeah, Vasilik is, you know, that's starter money. He should be starting. We talked about that enough. Chonkle, if that's his salary going forward, that really, you know, I know it's been debated whether or not he's a designated player or TAM, and with people reporting different things, that really puts him right on the edge. I think it's been reported it's a $3 million transfer fee. If he has a 3-year guaranteed deal, that's $1 million being attributed to his cap hit. So that puts him really close to that max TAM number. So I'm curious to see, you know, that it's really difficult to tell whether or not he's a TAM or a designated player. That was the only other thing I was hoping to get out of this at this stage in the season, because if Shankale was at $1.3 million, we'd know he's going to be a designated player. If he was at $400,000, we'd know he's probably going to be TAM. But it's really right in that middle zone of, boy, I don't know which way this is going to go.
Yeah. Supporter Summit took place this week. Brian Bilello answering some questions from the Rebellion and the Midnight Riders. Lots of good reporting on that one. The Blazing Musket had a story about it. The Rebellion had the full transcript. Any takeaways for you from what you saw from the Supporter Summit?
So I'm going to just run through kind of the major bullet points that I found interesting. He was first adamant that Bruce resigned and that they did not force him out, which I thought was pretty interesting. I mean, of course, he's going to say that, but he really seemed that there was very little to do with the investigation from the club side, and then he doesn't know much from what was publicly known. He expects the Shankle purchase option to be purchased. I mean, he really no commented pretty much everything on the field stuff, and he says that's up to the sporting director. But he said, you know, I would be surprised if the new sporting director does not pick up Shankle. Also mentions that the attitude change towards spending was pre-Bruce, which, yes, kind of true. Our payroll is still considerably high, and hopefully we have money to spend next year. And pending league rules, we will see where the club stands on our vision and how we want to get better each year. That is a quote from Brian. So it sounds like the Bruce years, we're still going to see the level of investment. They also said that the Revs are looking to hire different people for the head coach and sporting director roles, which is interesting. And I think that also means we won't see a superstar, quote unquote, head coach come in and kind of do a Bruce situation. I think we're going to see kind of more of a seasoned executive from MLS come in the sporting director role, and then maybe another MLS coach, someone we've talked about in the past. Petrovic, this is a very interesting, I think this is kind of the big key takeaways. This is a quote from Brian. When the Chelsea offer came in, we were toast. This is not a shot at Georgie, but the player was gone. He got an offer that he can't say no to. We're super happy for him. He's a great kid, but unfortunately it happened the way it did this summer, and we fought off offers for him and got away with it. And he also added that Chelsea said there was no chance at a loan. There was no interest from a loan from Chelsea, which, Sean, you and I are well aware of. Some people don't believe that, but we know that Chelsea was not interested in loaning him back because the Premier League was starting in the summer. And of course, why would you loan back a player spending $17 million on? But I think this kind of tells what we've been talking about, which is that, you know, Georgie was looking elsewhere when the initial bids came in. It really took a lot of pull to keep him here and say, you have to honor your contract and you need to turn down these raises and contracts from bigger offers. And, you know, the Revs were at a much better point of leverage because they could say, well, these offers aren't high enough. But it sounds like with the Chelsea offer and the line where he says, this is not a shot at Georgie, it sounds like Brian Bolello is tipping his hand that they had a lower value on Petrovic than Chelsea did. And Chelsea overpaid a little bit, which I think is the case. So I thought that quote was very interesting. Also, stadium stuff says moving to Boston makes them a jewel of MLS, but he's aware they will lose season ticket holders. And also he says that the team has had its lowest season ticket membership cancellations this year and will break the season ticket membership rates in 2024. And he also notes that 2024 season tickets are twice what it was in 2018, which makes sense since that was kind of a low point for the Revs. But I found the record season ticket membership in 2024 and also a low in cancellations very fascinating. And I think that adds context to the question of why does Brian have a job, which was a question we got from last week too. So it seems like from the business side of things, things are very, very well at Patriot Place. So those are the big key topics. I don't know if you had anything you wanted to add there, Sean.
Well, on the season ticket holder one, I imagine that Messi being in the league has helped with ticket sales as well, I will say. That's the one bullet point I would say that is worth noting. On Petrovic, I think that was a very interesting one. I guess not the most interesting part was how involved Crafts were in that decision, I guess, which is, I guess, not surprising because at the end of the day, it is their money. But that, I thought that was interesting. And, you know, again, you know, Chelsea wanted him now because they needed a backup goalkeeper. He's on their bench every game. And Robert Sanchez has a few more performances like he had this weekend. He might be starting soon. So they didn't want to wait to bring him in. He's a young goalkeeper. He, you know, needs to get acclimatized to the team. They had the need now. They weren't waiting. A team like that was not going to wait. So, you know, interesting stuff. No huge surprises. But yeah, I think that your key takeaways were the same as mine were.
I'll also say too, and I don't want to harp too long on this, but I thought the Rebellion did a really, really good job hosting this. I know a lot of people didn't feel this would be impactful or it wasn't the right thing to do. And, you know, I really appreciate Corey coming on and explaining the reasoning to why this course of action. And it seems like the reaction from this has been really positive, really on both sides, from the team and from the supporters. I mean, I guess not from the team. The team doesn't really make a comment from it, but it seems like the supporters got what they wanted out of it. It seems like Lolo was challenged at points, respectfully. And I think he answered these questions fairly well. So the Rebellion has a full transcript on their website, anyrebellion.org. I highly encourage everyone to, even though I've summarized the key points, give it a read through because it's full of very, very interesting information. And a little confused at the criticisms before. There was a little bit of criticism after on holding this event. But, you know, the Rebellion are, I think the people that went deserve a lot of credit for going and asking questions and demanding answers. And it's very easy to do that on Twitter and send out a tweet or on Discord and demand change. But, you know, it's a different thing going there and looking the club president in the eye and saying things. And I appreciate Corey, you know, making himself available for questions if someone couldn't make it or was not part of the Rebellion. It seemed like this was an event that was very well done. And yeah, I just want to give a major shout out to Corey and the Rebellion for doing this and providing a full transcript.
Yeah, it's great that they did this, and it's very great that they were able to write the full transcript as well. So I'm with you on all of that. One other piece of news, the Revolution have signed forward Malcolm Fry as a homegrown player from Revs 2, 18-year-old from Groton, Massachusetts. What can you tell me about him?
18 years old, signed to a three-year contract through 2026 with a 2027 option. He's the 13th homegrown player signed. He had 37 appearances with Revs 2. He had 6 goals and 3 assists. A little surprised that Jordan Adebayo-Smith was not signed. We talked about I talked about it with Caleb Pongratz last week. We talked about potential guys making the move up, and I did not mention Malcolm Fry, but he did. He added on some names, so I was expecting Adebayo-Smith to be signed more likely than Malcolm Fry. But I think the reason why is Adebayo-Smith is more of a striker. Traditional striker, I should say. Malcolm Fry, he's listed as a forward, but when you watch his highlights, he seems to be coming in from the wing a little bit. So he seems to be someone that could be a winger or kind of an inside forward. Seems to be a little bit, you know, flexible in where he can put him on the field. to me, this strikes me as a bit of a longer-term move, similar to Peyton Miller, similar to Santiago Suarez, where maybe he's not making a massive impact next season, but he's going to be a depth guy that's going to get minutes here and there. I'm also going to guess this seals Justin Reddick's fate. I do not expect him to come back because Justin Reddick right now is really your depth striker slash depth winger. Malcolm Frey, I think, can fill both of those roles, and he fits in nicely on the supplemental roster, younger, longer-term project. It seems like Justin Reddick's time, to me, this signifies that his time is up with the Revolution. I believe Justin Reddick, by the way, has taken out the Revolution from all of his social media handles and descriptions and stuff like that. Someone told me that a few weeks ago. So I'm guessing that this is Malcolm Frey coming in, not expected to make a major impact, and Justin Reddick is being forced his way out.
Are you surprised at the urgency of kind of this signing, that they've done it when, you know, lots of talk about things not happening until they make a decision on sporting director, that with all the interim guys that they made this signing?
Yes. And again, it's very confusing to me that, you know, Brian Blow, again, read the transcript, every decision, hey, it's going to be up to the new sporting director. And meanwhile, your interim sporting director is signing guys from the academy at, you know, and maybe, you know, maybe Anolfo, I mean, this is a longer term move. So whether or not Anolfo is here or not, you know, you could have made this move next year. So I don't know if someone is telling him to make these moves, or if he's doing these because he genuinely thinks this is the best thing for the club. But it is odd that, you know, there's kind of a time in flux and we're making this signing here. It's a little confusing to me.
Yeah, that part doesn't make sense to me, unless there's, you know, some interest from another team to bring him in, and this was a preventative move. So I mean, I'm not aware of anything, but that's the only way that, you know, the urgency makes sense to me. But again, it seems like a long-term move in that sense. It makes some sense. It's just weird that he's the guy they go out and sign now while they're still in the interim stage. Anyways, end of season awards announced. Carles Hill took home a lot of them. Team MVP, Team Golden Boot, Players Player of the Year, Midnight Riders Man of the Year. Good night for Carles Hill. Defender of the Year, Dave Romney, no surprise there. Academy Player of the Year, Olger Escobar. Any thoughts?
Well, on Carles Hill, we actually, who was our team MVP? That was a question we posted on the Blazing Musket for, I believe it's a subscriber-only piece, but we do a weekly roundtable, and that question came up, and I make my argument for why Carles Hill should be the team MVP. It really comes down to Carles Hill or Dave Romney. Some people, I think, would also throw Petrovic into that, but as someone pointed out to me, I don't think you should be naming team MVP someone who kind of quits on the team during League's Cup. So it really, to me, was between Dave Romney and Carles Hill. And Carles Hill is still a phenomenal playmaker. There was a lack of quality at the striker position, but Carles Hill still with a phenomenal season, 11 goals, 15 assists. Even if you want to just count primary assists, I believe he finished with 8, including the one from yesterday. He is 4th in expected assists, according to both American Soccer Analysis and FootMob. And by the way, Sean, do you know, according to FootMob, who had the best FootMob rating in MLS throughout the season? Do you know who it was?
I believe that was Carles Hill.
Carles Hill. Carles Hill is still one of the best playmakers in the league, and he had 11 goals. A phenomenal offensive performance from him. We really take this guy for granted, but a really, really good year, and a year which saw him with some poor strikers, Barrero out, Brandon Bae out on the right wing. There were some difficult challenges, and he really stepped up for this team. So no issue with the MVP. And do you have anything to add on that, or should I move on?
No, no surprises at all with him winning that award.
Quick, Olger Escobar, Academy Player of the Year, MLS Next All-Star. He was also the U17 MLS Next MVP. 15 goals in 17 appearances with the Revs U17. Also moved up to the U19 Revs team, which won their championship in July. He is signed to Revs 2. He only played about 500 minutes for them so far this season, so he didn't make that much of an impact. I expect him to get a lot more minutes with Revs 2 next season. And also, he's the 9th player to win the Academy Player of the Year award. This award goes back to 2014. Sean, trivia time. How many of the other 8 players that have won the Academy Player of the Year award can you name?
You said it goes back to 2014?
14, yeah. I'm putting you on the spot here.
Other than ones that have signed for the first team, probably none.
Oh, well, this is trivia. You got to name. Come on. Our listeners are listing off all the names, and they're really disappointed in Sean.
Is Justin Reddick on that list?
One. He's the only player to win it twice, 2015, 2016.
Is Damian Rivera on that list?
No. Oh, boy. Jeez. Oh.
Noel Buck?
Yep. 2.
Jack Peniotu?
Yep.
Is Esmer on the list? No, he wouldn't be.
Nope.
Yeah, he wouldn't be because he wasn't here very long. Yikes! I'm struggling.
one other player signed a first team contract with a team, and he won it in 2014.
Is that Diego Fagundes?
No, he was
before that, right?
Defensive midfielder, Sean.
Scott Caldwell?
No, Scott. Come on, academy. Who was in the academy in 2014? He had Shalry's number. Okay.
Oh, Haravu. Zach Haravu.
Embarrassing.
Yeah. Sorry.
I just want to list off these other names because some of them you might get. You might remember Trevor Burns in 2020, who's playing at Georgetown. You might remember Tyler Freitas, who came back and played with Revs too. Maybe you remember Kevin Vang in 2018 after he went over to play at PC. And then, of course, the legend Joe Brito, who I believe currently is playing with Union Omaha. I just wanted to kind of highlight those names: Haravu, Renix, Brito, Vang, Freitas, Burns, Noel Buck, and Jack Pentietu. The academy is getting better. I just wanted to kind of throw that out there to show how there's really been a steep incline in the last 3 years in the academy, and hopefully Escobar can continue. So, yeah, I thought you'd do better. I thought you were going to get Haravu and Renix right off the bat. You did get Renix right off the bat, but a little disappointed you couldn't get good old Zach.
You know, it's late at night. What can I say? I'm still on London time. last piece of news on my list is that Nicholas Firmino has signed a new contract with Atlanta United. So good for him.
22 years old, 3-year deal through 2026. Best 11 for MLS Next Pro. He scored 16 goals and 6 assists. He was also the 2020 USL League One Young Player of the Year, I believe, for Revs 2. And then they let him go. I listened to the podcast of the 2020 contract decisions back in the day, which was you, me, and Chris Feloukas, our good friend. You can tell back then we were very confused why we were letting go of Nick Firmino. We're really making up a lot of reasons that we think might be true, but it was definitely one that I remember at the time confused us. And I went back and I listened to it, and you could tell how confused we are trying to explain what exactly happened in letting Nick Firmino go. It is worth noting, you know, he did go to Union Omaha for a year, and he wasn't a full-time starter when they won USL League One championship. And then he went to Atlanta too, and has really developed over the past couple of years, scored a goal on one of the short-term call-up contracts earlier this year for Atlanta. And now he's got a 3-year contract, I assume, on a supplemental roster spot. So great to see him finally make it and get his footing and get a path back to Major League Soccer. But I do think you can kind of, you know, maybe back in 2020, he was not ready to make that leap and he needed a few years of development because it took him 3 years to get back into Major League Soccer. So, but I think when we see him play against the Revolution, if we see him play against the Revolution, if he does make a big impact for Atlanta, it's definitely going to feel like the one that got away. So very good for Nick Firmino. Don't be too good of a player, I'd say.
Yeah, and I mean, he was only 19 when the Revs got rid of him. So when you say he needed more development, they've given plenty of development to some of the other players that were that age, like Justin Renix. So it's an interesting decision looking back at it. Mm-hmm. That was it for me. I don't know. Do you have any final thoughts? Anything I missed?
There's more talk about Everett, blah, 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 blah. We can talk about Everett at a different time. More of the same. They're trying to get the same environmental stuff passed through. There's more smoke. It does feel like they are, and I don't want to necessarily say all in, but Everett is a real thing that the Revs are trying to make work, I would say, at this point. Whether or not they make it work, it's yet to be seen. But also, we got to give a shout out to our Bryant University Bulldogs, ranked for the first time in program history in the sport of soccer. So go Bulldogs.
Yeah, they have been absolutely amazing and a great storyline to watch. Still only one loss on the season. I'm very excited to see where they go from here. But nice to have our soccer team ranked. I used to do play-by-play for them years ago, and they were really bad. So I'm glad to see that they're good now, and I'm jealous of those that get to cover the team now.
Did you do it in a British accent?
You know, I should have.
You should have. Some people do that, and it really worked out for them years later. I will also say, I want our listeners to know, it looks like we're going to keep this under an hour and a half. That is a miracle. And I know I talked way more than you, Sean, and I apologize, but we were looking at this rundown and we were very concerned this was going to break an all-time record for longest podcast episode. And it isn't. We nailed it. So good for us. Thank you for listening. If you're still listening, thank you.
And with that, where can people follow you on social media? And I'll let you do the honors of giving out our social media.
I'll just give out the shows. Please follow us on Twitter at Revolution Recap. You can also follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and of course Threads. Be our friend on Threads. We need more friends on Threads. If you want to follow my personal account, it's at Real G Johnstone, although I really do not talk about soccer that much. I'm going to be talking about it at Revolution Recap. By the way, if you don't follow us on Twitter, please get us there. I think we're 2 off from 1,500. Let's get us over that mark. I think we're only 4 followers away from 400 on Instagram, too. So give us a follow. Come on. Let's go.
And you can follow me on Twitter at Sean L. Donahue. Also, be sure to rate and review us on iTunes, Spotify, wherever else you listen to podcasts. I think you can rate us on Audible. I think we only got one rating there. So if you use Audible, give us a rating. Be sure to check out our friends at The Blazing Musket. Thanks again for listening to Revolution Recap presented by Bet Online. We'll be back after the first playoff game with another podcast.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants. They all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.